orthogonal functions. They arise in a wide variety of contexts in physics. One common way they arrive is through separation of variables. So like I said, there are many different orthogonal functions. I'm not going to tell you everything you need to know about them. There's a number of great resources. My goal is really just to tell you about some of the tools that are available for manipulating them and a few of the important properties that you should remember. A lot of the detailed forms are available in any number of sources, Mathematica, for instance, but there are a few techniques that you should remember. So one common way that orthogonal functions arise is as solutions to differential equations that can be solved by separation of variables. And just let me briefly remind you how that works. So let's suppose we want to solve Laplace's equation in spherical coordinates. So in spherical coordinates, this equation just becomes this, where I have just broken up the derivative into a radial and angular parts. And L hat here is a differential operator that depends only on the angles. And so separation of variables, which you saw last week in your classical mechanics tutorial, is just assuming that the solution for phi factorizes into a function of r and another function of the angular variables, theta and phi. And if we plug this ansatz into the differential equation in this form, and then divide by phi, what we get is 1 over rr, partial squared rr, partial r squared, minus 1 over r squared, 1 over y, l hat squared y, equals 0. And so we see that the first term is independent of theta and phi. The second term is independent of r. So if this is going to hold for all values of r, theta, and phi, each of these terms must be equal to a constant, and the constant must be the same. So we must have l hat squared y is equal to some constant, which I'm just going to call l plus 1. Times y. And so if we plug that back into our equation, this gives us r squared d squared rr dr squared minus l plus 1 rr equals 0. And so this is the type of equation we want to solve. So it's a differential equation. We both want to solve for r and l. So in general, not all values of l will be allowed. So we can think of this as sort of the infinite dimensional generalization of an eigenvalue problem. So we want to both find the eigenfunctions r and the eigenvalues l. Or in this case, L plus 1. So the simplest problems of this type are described by what's known as Sturm-Liouville theory. And so we're not, that's in physics, that's in general the type of problems we want to solve fall into the Sturm-Liouville class. It's not completely general. There are other differential equations that we can say something about that fall into this class, but I'll focus on the Sturm-Liouville case. So, the Sturm-Liouville problem is we want to solve for the eigenvalues, eigenfunctions, and eigenvalues in some interval. AB. The equation we want to solve is that some differential operator omega acting on the eigenfunction, which is a function of x, plus lambda times w of x, u lambda of x, equals 0. So here, this is a differential operator. This is the eigenfunction. This is the eigenvalue. And W greater than 0 is what's known as the weight. So I claim the subject of our lecture is orthogonal functions. So let's figure out which solutions to this differential equation are orthogonal. Okay, so let's take this equation and multiply by another eigenfunction and integrate from A to B. So u lambda tilde integrated against omega u lambda dx is equal to minus lambda times the integral from A to B u lambda tilde u lambda w dx. And we could do the same thing, starting with the equation for u lambda tilde. And it's the same equation, except for omega is acting on u lambda tilde. And we get a u lambda tilde over here. So if we subtract these equations, we see that we get a condition for when u lambda and u lambda tilde are orthogonal. Okay, so we're interested in u lambda different from u lambda tilde, so this factor here is not zero. And so by orthogonal, what I mean is orthogonal with respect to the weight w. So this looks very much like our L2 inner product, except we have this extra factor of w. And so we can define this to be the inner product of u lambda tilde with u lambda with respect to w. So we're generalizing our notion of inner product. And if we do that, then this vanishes when the left-hand side vanishes. So the left-hand side vanishes, then we say that U lambda and U lambda tilde are orthogonal, and omega is self-adjoint or Hermitian. So we need to figure out when this left-hand side will vanish. Okay. So we'll be interested here in second-order differential operators. And the Sturm-Liouville form for the differential operator omega is this. And so if this is our differential operator, we can integrate by parts. And the integral from A to B of f omega g dx minus integral from A to B of omega f g is just s fg prime minus g f prime. Evaluated in A and B. So we see from this that whether or not our differential operator is Hermitian depends on the boundary conditions.
Is that making the claim that every Hermitian operator looks like that?
We restrict to second order differential operators. I believe that's a strong enough restriction. It's not true if we go to differential operators that are beyond second order, certainly. Yes.
What happens if we have degenerate eigenvectors? I mean, is that right-hand side vanishing anyway?
The eigenvalues are the same. Oh, on the bottom left. So if these two are the same, then U lambda and U lambda tilde are the same. So that means then this is just the inner product of the eigenfunction with itself. So that would tell you that if this vanished, then the eigenfunction had zero norm.
We can just generate lambda and tilde or lambda being the same doesn't necessarily imply that U lambda and tilde and U lambda are the same.
I'll come back to that point in a minute. Okay. So if we want this operator to be Hermitian, we need to impose boundary conditions so that the right-hand side here vanishes. Okay. So boundary conditions. As omega is Hermitian. And there's one subtlety here. We need to make sure that the domain of omega is the same regardless of whether it's acting on the first or the second function. That's automatically satisfied if we impose the same boundary conditions on f and g, which is usually what we want to do, but something to be aware of. So there are many ways we could make this vanish. The simplest case is separated boundary conditions, where we impose boundary conditions separately at the two ends, like we usually do in physics. So if S is positive, and A and B are finite, we can impose alpha 1 u1 of A plus alpha 2, u lambda prime of A equals 0, and beta 1 u lambda of B plus beta 2 u lambda prime of B equals 0, where alpha 1 squared plus alpha 2 squared are positive, and likewise for beta 1 and beta 2. So if we plug this in here, we'll get 0. So in this case, we have a number of results, which I'm just going to state without proof. It would take the entire lecture to prove these things. So in this case, the eigenvalues are real and distinct. So there's some smallest eigenvalue, lambda 0, and an infinite sequence that are distinct. Furthermore, the u sub lambda sub n form an orthogonal basis of L2 of AB with respect to the weight W. So that means that integral AB u lambda n of x u lambda m of x W of x dx is some normalization constant times the Kronecker delta nm. So these results should not be surprising. So, at least since I've called this a Hermitian operator. So we can think about, as I stated earlier, we can think about this problem as the infinite dimensional limit of the eigenvalue problem with finite matrices. So if we have a finite dimensional Hermitian matrix, we know that the eigenvalues are real and distinct, and the eigenvectors form an orthogonal basis. So these results should not be surprising. So that answers your question about whether the eigenvalues can be distinct. So if we impose these conditions, they're guaranteed to be distinct. That's right. Furthermore, the zeros of u sub lambda sub n plus 1 are in between the zeros of u lambda n and u lambda n has exactly n distinct zeros in the interior of A and B. So none of them are at the endpoints. So these are what's known as Sturm's separation and comparison theorems. Okay, and the first three points hold even if S is 0 at A or B. Or A or B is infinite. Okay. So in the case that A or B is infinite, we don't have to actually impose boundary conditions. We can just demand that the eigenfunctions lie in our space of square integrable functions. So that basically imposes that, in this case, we need to impose root w, u goes to 0 fast enough as x goes to plus or minus infinity, which is equivalent to just imposing that the u's lie in our space L2, AB. Okay. So let's look at an example in see what this means. So, example we'll look at is Hermite's equation. So, Hermite's equation is usually studied on the real line. So we don't need to impose any boundary conditions on our eigenfunctions. We just need to demand that they lie in the appropriate space L2, AB, W. And Hermite's equation is H double prime lambda minus 2x H prime lambda equals minus 2 lambda H lambda. So this is not in Sturm-Liouville form. So our differential operator doesn't look like this. So it's not immediately obvious whether what I've said is applicable. But we can just multiply by g to try to put it in Sturm-Liouville form. And if we compare that to the Sturm-Liouville form here, if we just expand that out, we get S U lambda double prime plus S prime U lambda prime plus T U lambda plus lambda W U lambda equals 0. So this is the SL form. And we can compare our two equations. And so we see that G equals S by comparing the second derivative term. We see that S prime equals minus 2GX. And so this gives us a differential equation for S, which we can solve. So we get S is equal to e to the minus x squared. Which is also equal to g. And comparing the lambda term, we see that w is equal to 2g. So that's equal to 2e to the minus x squared. But by rescaling h's, we can get rid of the 2. The overall normalization of the weight doesn't matter. So we'll rescale and get rid of this. So what have we learned? So we've learned that the solutions to this differential equation are orthogonal with respect to the weight e to the minus x squared. Okay, so if I compare this term with this term, I see that g has to be equal to s. Then I compared this term with this term, so that's minus 2gx is equal to s prime. So h here is the eigenfunction. So I've already applied the differential operator to our eigenfunctions in this case.
Where did the e to the minus x squared come from?
That's the solution to this differential equation. So if I can write this as so ds dx or ds over s equals minus 2x dx and integrate this. So if I just integrate that, I get this. Potentially times some constant, which I've set to 1. Yes?
So where did you take the s and t? Why are you using the s and t?
So that's the s and t. This is the Sturm-Liouville form. And the theorems.
Isn't that just like one specific? So every operator you try to bring into that form?
If we bring it into this form, then we can use the theorems that I've stated. Yes.
I'm just confused about when you said that you rescaled W. How did you do that?
So basically, I took u lambda to u lambda over 2. So if u lambda is a orthogonal basis, then u lambda over 2 is also an orthogonal basis. So I may have spoiled the normalization, but we haven't imposed any normalization to begin with. So.
May have been the particular choice of the constant of the solution of the differential equation. You can choose the constant to be 1/2 and then.
That's right.
And then you get precisely the W you're looking for.
That's also true. I could have just chosen the constant to be 1/2. Thank you. Okay. So what have we learned? We've learned that the solutions to this equation are orthogonal with respect to this weight. So we get this nice relation that hn hm e to the minus x squared dx is some normalization constant times delta m. You can also show that n here, n in this equation, has to be an integer. N and m have to be integers. The way you could show that is by, for instance, plugging in a series solution ansatz to this equation, and you'll find that the series you get only converges if n is an integer. I'm not going to show that, but this is the result of imposing that hn is in L2 of minus infinity with respect to the weight e to the minus x squared. Okay. So we can define functions that are orthogonal to the unit weight just by rescaling these h's. So we can define a phi n to be e to the minus x squared over 2 hn. And then the phi n's will be orthogonal with respect to the weight 1. So we have this. And if we want to figure out the differential equation satisfied by the phi n's, we can just compute hn prime in terms of phi n. And the result is e to the x squared over 2 phi n plus e to the x squared over 2 phi n prime. And hn double prime is e to the x squared over 2 phi n double prime plus 2x e to the x squared over 2 phi n prime plus 1 plus x squared phi n. So that just comes from using our definition and some algebra. So if we substitute these results in Hermite's equation, again, after a bit of algebra, we get phi n prime plus 1 minus x squared plus 2n phi n equals 0. And this equation should look somewhat familiar. We compare this to Schrodinger's equation for harmonic oscillator, which is this, after I've divided everything by h squared over 2m. We see that these two equations are basically the same. We can see it more explicitly if we make the change of variables, y equals ax, where a is root m omega over h bar. And that gives us this differential equation. Which is the same as the phi equation. So that tells us that the solution, the Schrodinger's equation, can just be written in terms of phi, which can be written in terms of the Hermite polynomials. So hn is up to some normalization, e to the minus a squared x squared over 2 hn of ax. So Aggie gave you this formula a few days ago. That's where it comes from. And we see, furthermore, from what we've learned about the orthogonality of the eigenfunctions and the allowed eigenvalues, that if we equate the constants in this equation and this equation, so in these two equations, we get that 2ME over h bar squared a squared, this term has to be equal to 1 plus 2n. And if we just rearrange this equation, this gives us E equals h bar omega n plus a half. This is En. So the quantization of the allowed energies is related to the fact that we have a discrete set of functions that solve Hermite's equations. So as you know, those HNs are polynomials. And orthogonal polynomials always satisfy recursion relations, which can be connected to the raising and lowering operators, the harmonic oscillator in the case of the Hermite polynomials. So to see that orthogonal polynomials always satisfy a recursion relation, we can show that in probably one blackboard. So we know that polynomials form a basis of L2AB. And so if we have a set of functions that form a basis, we can orthogonalize them using the Gram-Schmidt procedure, just like we would if we had a set of vectors that forms a basis of a vector space. So let's start with a degree zero polynomial. And if we want them to be, we could just set to be one, but if we want them to be orthonormal, we should normalize this. So the norm of one is not necessarily one in L2ABW. And we can get an orthonormal degree n plus one polynomial from the first n orthonormal polynomials just by first constructing a polynomial of degree n plus 1, which we can just do by multiplying x by a degree n polynomial, and then subtracting off the components of xpn along all of the I polynomials with degree at most n. So this is a function that points in some direction in our function space, and we need to subtract off the projection of xpn along that direction. And then again, if we want to make this orthonormal, we need to divide by some normalization factor.
You need to divide the factor by like xpn, like
the norm of xpn, otherwise it's
So this is a, if we want this to have unit norm, then we just choose this to be the norm of the entire thing.
You need to divide that by like inner product of xpn with itself. Otherwise, you won't be subtracting.
Which is going to be some cn.
Yeah. So we're assuming that we've already done this for the first n. So the first n are all orthonormal.
Alpha is just that.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
So alpha is just standing in for that, right? In the norm of the.
So alpha n, I can write that down explicitly, alpha n plus 1 is this, the norm of this. And so if we start, if the first ones has unit norm, then all of the rest will if we do it this way. Okay. Now this equation, basically after two more lines, implies a recursion relation.
Do you want to continue your meeting?
So
press 1 to confirm. If there is no response, the conference will end.
If we look at this inner product, what this is the integral from A to B of WPI x PN dx. And if we just group things differently, we can group things like this and see that this is equal to PN with x PI with respect to the weight W. But this has to be 0 unless I is equal to n plus 1 or greater. So this has to be 0 if I is equal to anything less than n minus 1. Because by construction, Pn is orthogonal to all polynomials of degree less than n.
Yes. My understanding, right, that if we are given the weight function W, then there's going to be exactly one set on this interval of orthogonal polynomials that is orthogonal for that W. Right.
So if we start with this, once we choose one, we could pick a different basis.
Oh wait, but this P0 is just some number, right? I mean, it's one, and then the norm of one is just a number.
You could start. You could probably make every single polynomial degree n if you want.
If we want them all to be of different degrees, then yes, what you're saying is
okay.
Correct.
Oh, but you could have a set that has some polynomials of the same degree that are still orthogonal. All
right. Yeah, I think you could.
Okay.
Not obviously. You can't do that. You could just take two and do some sort of transformation. Yes.
Could you please explain again why that inner product is zero for that values of I?
So, our construction, we start with one polynomial of degree zero, and then using this relation, we construct a polynomial of degree one that's orthogonal to all polynomials of degree 0. And then you do it again, construct a polynomial of degree 2 that's orthogonal to all polynomials of degree less than 2. So by construction, Pn is orthogonal to all polynomials of degree less than n. And if I is something between 0 and n minus 2, then x times Pi is a polynomial of degree between 1 and n minus 1. And so this sum collapses to a sum just from n minus 1 to n. So that tells us that we have a recursion relation, Pn plus 1 is some constant times, so some constant which is just 1 over alpha, n plus 1 times x pn, and then we have two terms here. So some constant times pn and some other constant times pn minus 1. So all orthogonal polynomials satisfy recursion relation of this form. The particular values depend on which set.
That they all got different degrees, right?
Yes. Okay. Furthermore, you can show that all polynomials satisfy a Rodriguez formula. So there's an explicit formula that involves derivatives of the weight, which takes different forms depending on the different formulas, depending on the different orthogonal polynomials you're interested in. For the Hermite polynomials, the Rodriguez formula takes this form. So here we have a power of the weight. Here we have an inverse power of the weight. For the other polynomials, sometimes there's additional factors that we take derivatives of, but they're all somewhat similar to this. I have notes from previous years where I showed where these come from, but in the interest of time, I cut that. But if anyone wants to see them, I can post them. So I'm just mentioning this because this is a useful tool for dealing with them. So you can. You can always look them up. If we combine the Rodriguez formula for the Hermite polynomials with the recursion relation that comes from the Gram-Schmidt procedure for the Hermite polynomials, we can derive a differential recursion relation. Rodriguez plus Gram-Schmidt recursion. So those two together, you can derive this formula. So this tells us that the derivative of an Hn is proportional to Hn minus 1. And so this should be suggestive of raising and lowering operators. So you can show, in fact, that raising and lowering operators are this formula implies that the raising and lowering operators work.
How do you know that all orthogonal polynomials satisfy a recursion relation?
So my assumption was that the polynomials, in particular, the polynomials form a basis of that. I didn't show that, but without the weight, that should be a familiar result to you. But it also holds if you put in an additional weight W.
The procedure on the left generates a specific set of polynomials, right? Not any polynomials.
You're starting at a constant. So that's the only possible degree of polynomial, and every polynomial generated from that is the only possible degree n polynomial.
Yeah.
So it's a thought of all previous ones, so it has to work.
It's good for you to
generate the right set. It's only dependent upon your wave function.
Yeah. So for some weight, you get a sequence.
Yeah, so our assumption was we wanted a set where we have one polynomial of each degree, and that the polynomials form a basis. So.
So you started with requiring one of each degree.
Yeah. One of each degree. If we didn't make that requirement, then.
Are you guaranteed with any differential operator, any, say, Stern-Liouville's differential operators that this will give you, that every similar Hermite polynomial has differing degree? So that's really.
This procedure automatically gives you something of degree Pn. Is always of degree n.
I mean, if you've got a problem, yeah.
That generates something similar to kind of polynomials, will they always all have degree dependent upon n?
No, they won't always be polynomials. So, I have notes from a previous year and tutorial problems from previous years where you can show that there's only a certain set of a and b and weights that give you polynomials. And it's a few pages, you can derive all of them.
Okay.
Yes?
The formula you got for Pn plus 1, the combination of the 3 n plus 1.
It's a combination of just Pn and Pn minus 1, but there's this one term as an x. Oh, we got that? So, this first term is just this first term. And I argued here that this sum from I equals 1 to n collapses to a sum from n minus 1 to n. So there's only two terms in this sum, and those are a term of some coefficient times pn and some other coefficient times pn minus 1. Okay, so one use of orthogonal functions is to approximate other functions. So suppose we want to approximate some function f as a finite sum of orthogonal functions. So here, un are orthogonal functions. Some set of orthogonal functions. Actually, I'm going to choose them to be orthonormal. And these are just coefficients. The best approximation you can do using a series approximation of this form is to choose the an to be the inner product of un with f. And this minimizes the square error between the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So this minimizes f minus n is 1, 2, n, a, n, u, n. And the minimum value is delta n is f squared minus sum n equals 1 to n, a, n squared. So often you want to approximate a function with a, say, a sines and cosines, if you want to do a, or a complex exponentials, if you want to do a Fourier series. And this result says that as long as you choose orthonormal functions, you don't have to recompute your ans every time you want to improve your approximation by adding more terms. So that's one nice use of orthogonal functions.
The norm you're minimizing with respect to here is the norm under W. Right?
Yes, yes. So it's always the same.
And can I ask, if W is just a constant function and you do this with, say, like with a set of Fermat polynomials, are you going to get the Taylor expansion?
You want to solve approximate a function in minus infinity infinity with Hermite polynomials? So then you're defining your inner product differently. So your weights would be different. So not necessarily would be the same. Yeah.
What is the basis of L to R dx, the mutual measure? What are the basis?
The basis for just L to with respect to the
With respect to the usual that I mentioned?
There's an infinite number of bases. We could choose polynomials. We could choose a number of other things.
Don't you have to go to, like, introduce a kind of Schwarz space and all that kind of stuff?
Right, yeah.
To make sense of it, because, you know,
makes sense.
So one basis, well, with respect to the weight, e to the minus x would be the Hermite polynomials. With respect to the unit weight, you'd have issues with convert. Yeah.
It's highly non-trivial to do. I think it might have even only been done like in the last 20 years or so to actually find a basis of L2 of R that can approximate smooth functions.
Right.
But I mean, you can just take basically kind of blocks and it works.
Okay.
Yeah.
You
have
to do something. Like,
no, that's for instance.
Okay, so this brings us to Parseval's theorem. Which says that if the function space is complete, then f of x equals some infinite sum converges for every f in the function space. So equivalently, delta n goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. Or f squared is the sum of a n squared. So let's look at an example to see what this means. So let's consider a wave with some amplitude and a period L. So a natural basis to try to approximate this function would be using a Fourier series. So we could write f of x as the sum from n is minus infinity to infinity of a n e to the 2 pi I n over L. And what Parseval's theorem basically says is that the total energy is the sum of the energy in each Fourier component. So we write U is 1 over L, integral from L over 2 to L over 2, f of x squared equals the sum from n equals minus infinity to infinity of a n squared. This over here is proportional to the total energy in the wave, and this is the sum of the energies in each of the Fourier components. That's what Parseval's theorem tells us. So let's look at a particular example. Suppose f of x equals x. So remember, we're choosing it to be periodic, so it looks like this. This distance here is L. And so U is just the integral from minus L over 2 to L over 2 of x squared dx, which is just L squared over 12. So that's the left-hand side of Parseval's equation. And let's compute the Fourier coefficient. Okay, so the zeroth Fourier coefficient is easy because it just vanishes by symmetry. It's proportional to the integral of x from minus L over 2 to L over 2. So a 0 equals 0 by symmetry. And a n for n not equals 0 is given by 1 over L, integral from L over 2 to L over 2, of x times e to the 2 pi I n x over L dx. And we can compute this by integration by parts. So if we do that, we get minus 1 over 2 pi I n x e to the minus 2 pi I n x over L evaluated at minus L over 2 to L over 2 minus the other term, which is the integral of e to the minus 2 pi I n x over L dx. And this term is 0 by symmetry. And we're left with minus 1 over 2 pi I n. Here we get L over 2 times e to the pi, minus pi I n x, and then we have minus minus L over 2, let me write it out, L over 2 e to minus pi I n minus L over 2, which is plus e to the pi I n. And so what this is depends on whether n is even or odd. So we get is 2 pi I n times minus 1, minus here. This sum is either 2 or 0, 2 or minus 2, depending on the sign of whether n is even or odd. So we get this result. We could write it as a cosine instead. It's writing it as a power of minus 1, because we're only interested in an integer, being an integer. So Parseval's theorem. Tells us that L squared over 12, that was our result for the left-hand side, is equal to the sum from n equals minus infinity, then not equal to 0, to infinity, of the absolute value of this, which is just L squared over 4 pi squared n squared. And manipulating this a bit, we get that pi squared over 6 is the sum from n equals 1 to infinity of 1 over n squared, which from yesterday is just zeta of 2. So we've computed zeta of 2. And using the functional relation from yesterday, you can go and compute zeta of minus 1 that Tibor told you about last week. Any questions on that? Okay. We can learn more from Parseval's theorem. Let's plug in the result for An for a general set of orthonormal functions Un and see what we get. So f of x is sum 1 equals n equals 1 to infinity, an un. And we know an is un f back to w. So if we plug that in, we get n sum equal from n equals 1 to infinity times the integral from a to b dxc of w of c un of c, f of c, all times un of x. And we can rearrange this to get the integral from a to b dxc times the sum from n equals 1 to infinity w of c un of c, un of x, all times f of c. And so we have f of x is the integral of something times f of c. So that tells us what this has to be. So this is true for any f. So we must have that this thing in parentheses is delta of x minus c. So this, so it's known as the completeness relation. It says if we sum up orthogonal functions weighted with w at different points, the result vanishes unless x equals c. And we can use this to solve an inhomogeneous version of the Sturm-Liouville problem. So suppose we want to solve the equation omega plus lambda w acting on y is equal to g, where g satisfies the same boundary conditions as y. Okay. And let's write g as, let's just pull out a factor of the weight. So let's write this as wf. So we can expand both y and f in terms of orthonormal functions. So we can write y is a sum of an un. And let's choose our basis to be the solutions to the homogeneous. Sturm-Liouville equation. We can perform a similar expansion for f. I'm going to call the coefficients fn. And let's plug this back into our equation and see what we get. So get sum an omega plus, oh, I should mention this. So here we're considering this to be just some fixed number. It's not necessarily one of the eigenvalues of the original homogeneous Sturm-Liouville equation. Okay, so if we plug in our series expansions for y and f into our equation, what we get is this expression here. And since we've chosen un to be the eigenfunctions of our differential operator omega, we can write this as the sum of an lambda n w plus lambda w un. So now we can multiply both sides by um and integrate. From minus a to from a to b. So that will just pick out one term in the sum. And so that tells us that am times lambda m plus lambda is fm. And so we can plug that result back into our expansion for y. Now we know what fn is by Parseval's theorem. It's just the inner product of f with un with respect to the weight w. So if we put that in, we get the integral from a to b, dxc, w of xc, un of xc, f of xc. And we can manipulate this equation just a bit. And write this as integral from a to b, dxc times the sum un of x, un of xc over lambda n plus lambda times w of xc, f of xc. And this here is just g of xc. and this thing here, then must be the Green's function. Which Dennis will tell you about more the week after next. And to see that, so we've written y of x as an integral over some object times the inhomogeneous term in our equation. And just to check, if this behaves like you'd expect, we can act with the differential operator omega plus lambda w on G. So this operator is with respect to x. And what we get is the sum u n over lambda n plus lambda omega plus lambda w u n, which, because un's are eigenfunctions, we can write as u n, this is of c, and this is of x. So we can write this omega on un of x as lambda n w and the lambda n plus lambda cancels. This just gives us the sum un of xi w of x un of x, which as I showed earlier, is just delta x minus xi. So I'm not going to tell you how to compute these functions. I'll leave that to Dennis. But you can see why this works from a different perspective. OK, so that's all I wanted to say about orthogonal functions. So we learned a few different techniques for manipulating them. We saw the recursion relations, saw the completeness properties. In tutorial, you'll learn about generating functions, which is another important way to manipulate orthogonal functions. But the main thing you should be aware of is the tools you have at your disposal for dealing with orthogonal functions, because the details change depending, some of the details change depending on which orthogonal functions you're dealing with, but I hope you have some sense of the tools that are available at your disposal, and more of a sense after the tutorial. Any questions? Okay, so tomorrow we'll wrap up by discussing asymptotic series and ways to approximate integrals that will have some applications to our QFT courses later.